Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be speaking with Daniel D.H. Boggs, who is one of the foremost RPG researchers, archaeologists, and is a specialist in Dave Arneson's Blackmoore campaign. Welcome, Daniel.
Hello, and welcome. It's great to be here.
So this is very exciting. So we have not had a special guest on Wandering DMs before. So I think Paul and myself, we're going to be kind of seeing how this goes. So thank you so much for bearing with us. Paul, we have the comments up if anybody wants to ask Daniel a question, right?
Absolutely. I'll be keeping a close eye on the chat this stream. So if anybody is out there has some questions for Daniel, please post them and I'll be sure to relay them.
Cool. So I think, Daniel, a lot of people are talking about Blackmoore this year, partly because there was a documentary recently released about it, right?
Right. After 6 years of research and interviews, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we know where that is available to folks that we want to send them to, or is that generally
there
available?
There is a web link. I don't know where it is. It's easy enough to find, and there's also a Facebook page.
Okay, great. We'll put some links in the comment section of this video afterwards.
And it's, you know, it's called Secrets of Blackmoore. I think it's on Vimeo,
Vimeo,
Great.
Right. So a lot of us were, patiently waiting for that for a long time and hearing about them shooting it and so forth. Now, I haven't actually personally seen it yet, which I'm embarrassed to say. Daniel, have you actually seen it, probably?
Yes. Yes, I've seen. The last time I watched it was about a week ago. I do know that there may be small updates. You know, it's a live thing, so they can change it. There was a typo on one of the names. I think that got fixed recently.
Okay, but cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So I think one of the things you were showing Paul and I just before this is I guess people doing this have dug up the earliest known map of Blackmoore and people saw it in that documentary for the first time.
That's right. Yeah, so this map was enclosed with a letter in March of 1971 it was from Arneson to Rob Koontz. As the, what was he then, editor of the Domesday Book, something like that.
Right,
And so this map now, it's interesting to say it's the earliest map of Blackmoore. It is the earliest map of Blackmoore, but nowhere in the accompanying documents is this called Blackmoore. In fact, there's a list of four different territories. And if you look closely, you can see little dotted lines. The area was meant to be divided up into different territories. And one of those territories was, there's a character in Blackmoore lore known as Marfelt the Barbarian. And that was the character of Marshall, I'm going to butcher this last name, Hoogfelt. I don't really know. He passed away about 3 years ago, I think.
Okay.
And he had a province known as Keystone, which the other ones I can identify because there's Williams Fort, which is on the, if you're looking at the screen, it would be on the right side. There's the swampland, which is easy enough to see. And then so that middle province, which if you look right in the middle of the map, there's one castle that's colored black. And that is the castle that is in the right location to be Blackmoore.
Okay.
In fact, this map is almost exactly identical to the maps that you'll see throughout the publication history of Blackmoore.
Yeah, it seems very similar to my arc. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Was this, so remind me, was this based on some, do people think this was based on some real world geography at one point?
So Arneson said that at the time that he drew this map, they were doing a Napoleonic campaign in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And so this was supposedly based on a Netherlands map.
Yeah.
And if you look at the top left corner, that sort of straight strand there,
that's
actually different from Blackmore maps we have now, only in that there's that's a solid piece of land, but the maps we have now, that there's an open channel there.
Right.
Anyway, that piece of land looks an awful lot like a certain part of Holland from 19th century maps.
Yep.
But the rest of it is just, like, I tried to match it up to different maps and whatnot, and it's like, other than that little bit,
okay,
I couldn't really see anything that,
okay,
you know. So whether he just started with, you know, maybe used something for inspiration, or whether it actually does copy something, I don't know.
Gotcha.
So this you said this map was found in a letter. Is that right?
Right.
Was that just like a normal correspondence, or was it part of like a play by email game, or do you know any context of that letter?
It was part of the normal correspondence. Arneson was setting up what his world would be like, and I think the intention was for this to be part of the Domesday game world map, which I don't think had been drawn at that point yet.
Okay.
So when exactly Arneson drew this map, I don't know.
Okay.
It's prior to chainmail. This is prior to chainmail being published.
Interesting.
If you look at it, it's a pretty, I guess you'd say, well drawn or carefully drawn.
Yeah.
It's map. Very detailed. And whenever I look at the Blackmore maps, and they're all fairly similar, like, I think, geez, that's a lot of water. Like, if I was just inventing something out of pure creativity, I never would have put so many intricate waterways and rivers and streams. It's a little complicated to look at, actually, which always makes me think that had to be some real thing, because I would never have thought to put so much intricate waterworks in there.
Right. You know, especially for a war game, because there's not a lot of maneuver possibilities there, right? You know?
Right. Good point.
So, viewer John Miller is asking some questions about how this map compares to the Netherlands map in terms of like scale, and is there any good resource to look at a map of the Netherlands that you think is comparable?
So I don't know.
Yeah.
And there's no scale on this map.
Yep. Yep.
And that's been a running thing with Blackmore maps.
Right.
There's scales that jump all over the place, from 20 miles. You know, per inch to 40 miles per inch to some people have it being like the size of half of Europe and others the size of Ireland. So,
okay, that really burns my chaps. I'm just going to say that personally really burns my chaps, because that's the first thing I want to know is what is the scale of the map and how much territory is this covering? And that's the first thing I want to know before anything else.
Right.
But that is actually fairly common for like TSR publications. There's a lot of publications that vary wildly, and I think like the third edition Eberron world has the same thing of what's his name wrote it one way, and then they multiplied it by 10 for the publications. So they tended to do that for publications a lot, apparently, which drives me crazy. So I agree. Like John's question is good. If we don't even really know what the scale was supposed to be, then it becomes a much harder problem to match it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. So it's interesting. So you mentioned this is before chainmail came in, and so then you have the question about what mechanics did Arneson use to run the game in Blackmore, and of course I'm a big mechanics guy myself. I think that mechanics matter. As well as other things. Mm-hmm. So I'm always interested in what the mechanics are. Now, there was a blog post recently in which someone was talking about, so I guess, what's his name? Bob Meyer, right?
yes.
Runs Blackmore games these days.
Yes.
How continuous is that? Was there a direct swap off between Arneson and Bob, or how continuous is that really?
My understanding is indirect swap off would be a better way to say it. I think what happened was that Arneson was planning to run one of their anniversary games, and this was near the end of his life, when he was not well, and couldn't make it. And so Bob stepped in at that point. I think that's what happened. He's been doing it ever since. Most of those guys don't really want to, you know, they want to play. They don't want to run. So
they don't want to run, really?
No.
What?
I'm so glad it's not me that broke Dan this time. Well done, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
But is that not the best thing?
It allows the most creativity, right?
That's crazy. Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so Bob took up the mantle, I guess.
Right. And, you know, and some of them are still only about half sold on the whole fantasy thing. they'd rather be playing, you know, Russian Dragoons in pick a battle.
That's amazing. Really? That's really amazing. Mm. Huh. Now I'm I am kind of broken by that. That's amazing. I mean, you know, I'm trying to compare that to my taste of like getting started with, you know, like Holmesian D&D and then me being the cranky old man about like tieflings and warlocks. And, you know,
I don't even know what those things are.
Right. Well, there you go. I barely know what those things are. Yeah. So I can see getting stuck on a particular thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so as far as Mr. Myers runs it now, someone did a blog post and like one of my friends was very interested in this. And the claim is at least Mr. Myers runs it with very, very low stats. Like the characters don't have stats. You are supposed to describe your character narratively with one single word. And one of my friends said, wow, that's like really surprisingly new school narrative type gaming. But the claim at least is that's how Dave Arneson ran it. To your knowledge, is that how Dave Arneson ran it with like purely narrative descriptors and no numbers?
No, although it would vary a bit between players.
Okay.
And I think what he thought they were interested in knowing. So like with McGarry, with his sheets, you know, we've got all of his stuff. But with Greg Svensson, for example, now you got to remember these were in 1970, 72, you know, these guys are 18, 19, 20 years old.
Right.
And Arneson wasn't that much older either. He's mid-20s.
Okay.
So some of them would have been more trustworthy with things and more interested in numbers, and others would have been like, okay, how do I play, you know?
Okay. And when you say trustworthy, you're saying like keep track of your character's hit points kind of thing?
Well, probably not hit points, but other stats, and keep your sheet. You know, I know that you'll bring it back next week whenever you come to play and not have lost it or had it, you know, tossed in the trash by your mother or whatever.
Okay.
And I think Arneson kept, you know, Greg Svensson talks about 3x5 cards.
Yeah.
Pretty sure that Arneson kept separate records. There's a couple of reasons I say that. Aside from the fact that, you know, this is the recollection coming from the players,
right?
That he kept separate records on the characters. And one of the things that he kept that the characters didn't keep was hit points.
Okay. Interesting.
And I think the reason for that is they all had the same hit points, and we know what those are only because when Greg moved to an apartment, I think in a place called Mantinko, St. Paul somewhere.
Right.
He was living with a couple of the other guys, offhand. I better not say because I'd have, you know, I might get somebody mixed up there. But a couple of the other guys, and they were playing Blackmore games, and Greg was the guy running it, probably because he had just designed Taunuspor.
Gotcha.
So he needed to know some basic rules. So Arneson gave him some prices for things. He gave him the stats of how many hit points you have at different levels and stuff like that. And he wrote that all into his second edition chainmail, which is the one they used the most when they were referencing things.
Okay, interesting. You know, it's interesting. You know, it's interesting about the, like, who keeps the records and like who maintains the paperwork. It's not something that we discuss a lot because it's like we tend to all have our own habit. And the other thing that sometimes comes up with Paul and me is like when I was playing with junior high school friends in the 80s, my players cheated. Like my players totally were willing to cheat all the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of my mechanics and methods were dealing with that. And Paul's usually surprised when I say that.
Yeah.
You know, now like I trust my player, you know, the players I have, I can trust a lot more. And I don't have to worry about that, which is nice.
But still, like I know my own experience as well, growing up learning the game from originally the Molvay basic set and then layering in the first edition player's handbook. I always think of first edition AD&D when we talk about who keeps what records, because of course the basic attack matrices are not in the player's handbook. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, the only way that I, as a, you know, 10-year-old reading the player's handbook could make sense of the game was to layer in elements from the basic set. Like, it was not a complete game per that one book.
Right.
Good point.
And then in retrospect, I always wonder, like, are they implying a way of playing here that, like, the DM is supposed to roll all the dice? Is that what?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe? And it says as much in the original rule books, right? That there's a line in there about, you know, rolling up characters it's like your DM is rolling up your characters and then hands you the numbers.
It totally says that. Yeah, it totally explicitly says that. Original D&D says the DM will roll the ability scores to help the players decide what class to run.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, again, I think about what would that be like? Like if I had half pre-generated characters at the table and like handed people a list of statistics and now you can choose your class. Would that be an interesting way to get the game started?
I mean, at some point you just run into like the way I often run convention games, which is here's a bunch of pre-generated characters, pick one. Right.
Yeah. Right. So in that regard, what did Arneson do? Was he rolling dice for attacks and hits and stuff like that? Or were the players?
I think he was rolling most of the dice that had anything to do with something the player's not doing directly. So I think the players were rolling their dice for the character.
Okay.
And so if we go by what people say now or have said in the past 30 years.
Right.
The recollection seems to be that they're rolling dice, and I've got at least three different people saying they're rolling under 2d6 stats.
Okay, yeah.
In order to get things. And that would be John Snyder, Dave McGarry, and Greg Svensson have all said that separately in two cases without being prompted. So, but plus we've also got Dave Arneson saying the same thing in a secondhand report. By Robert, I think his name is Leonard or Lionheart, in one of the, what was that? One of the, not Knox Bell.
Fight On, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Fight On, right? In the one that was a tribute to Arneson, that article.
So and so that was pretty recent. That was just the last couple of years kind of thing.
Right, it was like a couple of years before Arneson died. He supposedly told him all these things that he used to do. And even if you look at the Adventures in Fantasy game, which was published in 1979, that's all roll under stats. The stats are all now percentiles, but it's the same.
Okay.
Same thing.
Gotcha. So one of the real treasures that I think that Dave McGarry shared with you, Daniel, was his earliest character records.
Right.
And you posted them on your blog some number of months ago, maybe last year. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should take a look at that right now, because sure. I thought that was just completely invaluable.
I don't think I have that.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh no.
You guys can give me that.
Okay. So
if I can dig it up real quick, I'll find it. You guys talk and I'll dig it up.
Okay. Sorry about that, Paul. So if we can't pull that up, look at D.H. Boggs' blog and you'll find it. And so like you're saying, they're all in a 2D6 type range. So the McGarry character records have like what, about 30 different ability type things, and they're all in the range of 2 to 12, basically.
It's maybe 30. It's probably not quite 30, but and it reduces over time. So if you look from the second sheet, from the first sheet to the second sheet, those numbers go down, and or the categories go down.
Right.
Many of which I did a comparison. You see on the blog. Are carried on into the Adventures in Fantasy game, which is interesting.
Right.
But yeah, it looks like the modus operandi seems to have been basically that your character is a whole bunch of saving throws.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's very compatible with Chainmail's 2d6 man-to-man type charts. And the other thing I noticed is that at least on the first page of his records, the last 20 things are all the exact same weapons in the exact same order as the chainmail combat charts.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. That definitely, I mean, there's no question that's pulled right out of chainmail. And in fact, the exact order of all of those weapons. And you see the same thing in the first fantasy campaign in the price list.
Right, so. Right. Good point. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which I should say, for people that don't know, First Fantasy Campaign is the name of the booklet published by Judges Guild originally in 1977 of the collection of mostly of Arneson's campaign notes. It also contains 3 or 4 articles that he had written for different things. One of them is the facts about Blackmore, which was published in the Domesday Book, I think 13, somewhere around July 1972. And he just reprinted that. There are some interpolations in it, and I've been sort of putting out feelers trying to get a scan of the original article to see exactly, what may have been stuck in there or changed, but I don't think it's much, but.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So there's that. And then a few articles that look like they were things that were cut from the supplement 2.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's interesting because I just recently, this summer, I got to read First Fantasy Campaign for the first time. Mm. And I had been trying to get my hands on it for years. And I really need to add this to my library. And mm-hmm. I finally got my hands on a copy this summer. And I was overjoyed at being able to read it. Mm-hmm. And was, very dense, right? That's sort of the way it was at the time is stuff is pretty densely written. And it's not super long, so I was pretty happy to have it. And so now we have, of course, the Dave McGarry character record on the screen here. And mm-hmm. you can see that, to my mind, that's a lot of numbers.
Yeah.
So when people are saying that the early games were really low crunch and were narrative-based, and I look at this, I'm like, that's actually way more numbers than I would want to hand to a beginning player now.
Right.
That's a lot. Of course, every column's a different character there.
Yes.
Every row.
Some of those characters were very short-lived, and others quite long-lived.
Gotcha.
The first one, and so here's another thing that we might want to get into a little bit, so I'll just bring it up. McGarry's first character is not him. Right. Okay. So you'll frequently hear, oh, well, Blackmore, they were just playing themselves, which is true. Right. Sort of.
Right. I read that in the John Peterson book saying that.
The first game for a lot of those guys seems to have been an adventure that took place probably right after Dave Arneson got back from a graduation present trip. Well, I guess it was a present, a trip that he took to Europe in the summer of 1971. He went to Norway and Great Britain. Whether he went anywhere else, I'm not sure, but he definitely went to those two places. They only made 2-3 weeks.
Great.
got back, and they run this adventure where Dave, his plane crashes in Iceland on the return trip.
Right.
And so he's somehow lost in Iceland, and his buddies have to go rescue him. And in the process of which they go on a river that goes through a cave or something like this. I mean, you know, you hear different stories, and it was 40 some years ago. So, and they end up in this magical land, which it's a common trope that we all use. Like, oh, there's a magic doorway, and you step through, and all of a sudden you're in this other place where I really wanted you to have your adventure. You know,
right.
So they have an adventure there, and the characters that are playing it are just themselves.
Gotcha.
So Wesley was part of that. It was apparently at a time when he was home on leave, and it's one of the things I've said to him a couple times, like, yeah, we need to get your records on exactly when you were home on leave, because I'm sure that's available somewhere. Yeah. I don't know how you get it, but
that's a good point. You know, it's funny about the occasionally playing yourself, because this just came up with our good friend Max that I was with on Friday night, and he said the last time he went to a convention, he got to a game a little bit late and missed like the first 5 minutes of intro. They said, you know, make up your character. And he took it was like a modern type thing. So he took a character sheet and said, "I'm going to be like a big biker." And so my character is a biker. He's got a bunch of tattoos, and he's very strong, and he's a motorcycle, and he's also a hacker. And then later on, he realized that the intention was to write up stats for your real life person, right? So our friend Max is a very tall, very skinny, not biker person at all. And so everybody was like really offended that they'd made this, it looked like he'd made himself out to be this completely fallacious doppelganger.
Right.
Self-identify. Right? So once upon a time, that was like a more conventional way to get into a game, is that you are playing yourself maybe, to somewhat younger gamers like our friend Max, that was like completely the last thing you'd expect in the world.
Mm-hmm. So with Blackmore, that convention kind of continued all the way through, but it was really quickly some of the guys started changing that. So Pete Gaylord, his first character was a wizard.
Okay.
You know, and he called himself Pete, but he was a wizard, so he's not himself. McGarry plays a thief called McDuck.
Right.
Ross Maker played a dwarf who never really did seem to have a name. But, you know, they took on these fantasy characteristics or characters right away. And they didn't really distinguish them. So there was, if you want to talk about classes, there's only two what we would call classes. And that'd be warriors the right way to say it would be wizards and people who aren't wizards.
Gotcha. Which is right out of chainmail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I think, with the ranking system is definitely drawn out of chainmail. So these things, you know, chainmail is the go-to resource for these guys, in part because it's the shiny new thing.
Okay.
You know, and it has stuff in it. It has monsters, it has stats, it has things. So that's what they're using. But they're not really using the system. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that these guys were had been wargaming for years together, and they did things, a lot of the things, especially Arneson, seems to have done a lot of stuff on the fly according to, you know, whatever general conventions they had been following.
Okay.
I mean, you know, that just to touch back on that, like playing yourself, right? Playing yourself and whatnot, I think is much more explainable when you consider the time and the place, right? Like, you know, fantasy is also reasonably new, right? Like, so perhaps, you know, you need that bridge, right? You're talking about players who as you mentioned, Daniel, maybe aren't even sold still to this day, aren't sold on fantasy, right?
Right.
The corollary that immediately jumped into my mind was the start of Acquisitions Incorporated. The guy who made one of the guys from Penny Arcade made a character named Jim Dark Magic, right? As I'm a magic user, I'm a wizard. My name's Jim Dark Magic, and it, you know, became a pun throughout that series.
Yeah.
But I think potentially he was just not accustomed to all the tropes that we are all have so internalized at this point.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely. And for a lot of them, well, it depended on what they read, right? So for some of them, their touchstone was the Lord of the Rings. And for other guys, you know, they were reading the Gore books and they were reading Conan and all this stuff. Going back to the letter that accompanied the map, when you look at that, there's reference. It's unspecific, but there's references to Picts. There's references to the Red Wizards, and there's another thing. A couple of things that make it look like the way Arneson was setting this up originally was very Howardian, very Conan-esque. That was his original vision. And when he gets chainmail with all this Tolkien stuff in it, that changes how Blackmoor was put together.
Yeah,
I find those kind of things really interesting because, like, on the one hand, I kind of expect people to have like a very firm campaign world idea. Mm. And then these kinds of influences come in and they're very, very liquid. They're very, very fluid about how willing they are to, you know, just graft new brand new stuff onto it from time to time.
Sure. You know, that may be one of the things I think that translates from Blackmoor into D&D is that very fluidity. And that all goes down to Arneson's sort of willingness to just throw everything into the pot.
Yeah.
You know, one of his main players was Dwayne Jenkins, and Dwayne Jenkins loved Dark Shadows, and he wanted to be a vampire. So
and that was the that was the TV soap opera, vampires, werewolves, and stuff like that. Yeah.
It was just, you know, this is 19th century gothic horror. It's got nothing to do with Conan or you know, Tolkien and the elves, and yet it's all thrown in there from the start, almost from the start.
Fascinating. Yeah. So when you mention, you know, use the way they use chainmail, I feel like in some circles it's actually contentious. Like, I've seen some people like really push back against never use chainmail. They never use anything from chainmail.
Mm.
And so it sounds like with what you're saying, they're using some of the thematic content without specifically using like the specific combat tables. Is that the gist I'm getting?
Yeah, although there was at least one game early on when they used the fantasy combat table, according to what Arneson repeatedly said. And he would say like two or three games or two or three weeks or, you know, the story. The one thing about Arneson you got to understand is he was as friendly with hyperbole as our current president is.
Okay.
So just think of it that way.
Interesting.
So, you know, you take the basic fact and like, okay. So we strip away the what may be exaggeration there and look at what he says, that they used the fantasy combat table for at least one game, and Bob Meyer was the guinea pig in that game.
Okay.
And we actually have a report that seems to be talking directly about this game. One of the earliest, I think it's the second reference to Blackmore in the Corner of the Table newsletter, which was the newsletter that Arneson typed up and sent out to his gaming group. Theoretically, I think it was monthly, but it didn't work out that way. But anyway, in that newsletter, I think it was April 17th, was the date scheduled for a Blackmore game that would involve, it was a medieval Bronstein that would involve a poker game under a troll bridge. So we have a report from Bob Meyer, the guy who is does the DMing for the Blackmore group now, that his first experience with Blackmore was playing in a game where there was a troll under a bridge. So it looks like it must be the same game. And his experience was that he was a hero, which again, drawing straight from chainmail. Mm-hmm. There was a situation where there was a fight going on under the bridge. I guess the poker game had gone sour, and his character charges in to attack the troll, thinking, hey, I'm a hero, I'll make short work of this guy. And the troll does one attack and kills him, which is what you get on the fantasy table. Yep, it's right, roll yep. Under, you know, it's like
either dead or not dead, basically.
Either, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which totally pissed him off, basically. And he says he didn't play Blackmore for months, if not a year or two after that.
Okay. Okay.
So my feeling is, and you get the sense from what Arneson wrote about that, is that incident and Mr. Meyer's reaction to it really soured him on using that particular system. Although I'm pretty sure that the rest of the players, when they had reason to, did use the fantasy combat table for some of their games. Because, and this goes to what we're talking about, Arneson wasn't easily forthcoming with his rule methods.
Okay.
Right? Mm. So the other guys had to resort to either using what they had available or making up their own in certain cases. Like I said, when Svensson became DM for his group, or a GM, I guess you would say, Arneson gave him some guidelines for some things, but it's a page worth of stuff, and it's not a lot. It's just basic things. So what would he have to use for combat and so on and so forth? He would have to use chainmail for that. Where was I going? So that incident with the troll under the bridge is likely what led him, in my opinion, to create the character sheet matrix that you see with Megger.
Okay. Gotcha.
We have a viewer question, which I think slides in here pretty well, which was if you have any knowledge on how spells and magic worked, right? Like, so I'm curious whether it's literary influence. Do we see Vancian-style magic? Do we see stuff from chainmail? Was he making stuff up on the fly?
And I got to say, when I read First Fantasy Campaign this summer, I had the same question. I was like, I still can't tell exactly what you're talking about for the magic.
Right. So First Fantasy Campaign is the primary source for that. There's a couple of interviews that Arneson did, but so Pete Gaylord wanted to be a wizard. Chainmail had maybe four spells in it, the first edition. It had lightning bolt, it had fireball, it had, I think, darkness, and in the section of describing some of the monsters, you get things like invisibility. There's barely anything. So, and I also don't think it was the case that Arneson was sitting there, you know, scouring through his chainmail book, trying to find things, trying to find answers. These were creative guys. They had lots of experience gaming, and they had all sorts of interest in literature to draw from.
Right.
He didn't need to do that, and he didn't have a motivation to do that. So when P. Gaylord said, I want to be a wizard, Arneson's solution was, okay, so wizards make spells by mixing things together in laboratories. So it was alchemical.
Okay.
And you have to go get resources, which was an avenue then for him to craft adventures for, I'm going the wrong way here, for the wizard to go get what he needed.
Right.
And shortly, I don't know that this happened right away, but fairly early on, there was an incident. So the normal operating procedure for their games was they had a ping pong table in Dave Arneson's basement, and they would cover this with brown paper, the sort of brown paper that Paul has behind his head there.
In fact, just quick interjection, at that game, Dave McGarry pointed out that we were using that same original ping pong table.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, had the table.
Yeah, he brings it with him to conventions. He brings ping pong table to conventions that he got from Dave Arneson.
Yeah.
So we both played on that at GaryCon last year.
That's totally awesome.
Yeah. Huh.
So just like that.
Yeah.
But they did have props. Like, they had the model of the castle that they used. And one of the props that they had, I think probably from a train set, were these little orange trees. And the oranges, these little balls, were stuck on there, and they kept falling off on the table. And so they decided that, okay, these are super berries. Where these trees grow is the great magical wood. And so Pete Gaylord becomes the wizard of the wood, and he makes his spells by brewing up things out of these super berries, which draw their magical energy out of the ground, because Blackmore is this magic. This is how all this storytelling develops out of, you know, a simple prop.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. That's nice. It's nice.
Yep.
Interesting. So does it seem like the magic was more free form? Like, it would come up like, this session, I want to cast a teleport, and we're just making the teleport up on the fly? Or would
I think so. You've got the basic spells of lightning and fireball.
Right.
But then other things, I think they had to say, or they would just say, I want to be invisible. So, okay, well, maybe you can brew a potion that does that.
Okay.
And now we've got potions of invisibility. I know with Dave McGarry's dungeon game, he's got a spell in there. It's not teleport, it's transference, which is the same thing.
Yep.
But, you know, it's just a different I think that may be drawing on Star Trek. And there's Star Trek tossed in there too.
Yeah.
Right.
And that goes back pre-Blackmore with the whole phaser that kills the elephant game.
I mean, if I could do a little conjecture here, and I'm maybe way off, but I mean, this kind of area sounds to me where, like, maybe you get those arguments that there are no rules, there are no numbers, we just made it up, right? And it certainly jives very much with, again, at that same GaryCon, I got to play a Brownstein game run by David Wesley. Mm-hmm. And there were no dice. There were no numbers on the sheets we were given. It was just background, and he was just making stuff up as he went.
Yeah. And that's definitely the case. I mean, the way I would trace the lineage is that I mean, honestly, I think what we play now are Bronsteins. They're just more complicated.
Interesting.
I don't make that distinction. But then I'm in anthropology, we have a thing called lumpers and splitters, particularly physical anthropology, and I'm definitely a lumper. You know, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck.
Okay.
So
I think I saw John Peterson talk about that issue, because I think at some point Dave Wesley described his first Bronstein as a failed war game, a war game that failed to take place, and so John's really clever quip was, we've been failing to play war games for a long time now. Right? And I really like that myself.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's interesting. You know, it's interesting, and I've seen this with both Arneson's games, and I've seen this with, you know, reports of Wesley's games, is different. There's totally this Heisenbergian, Rashomon, like, different people have wildly different reports about what happened in different Arneson games and different Wesley games. I've seen just diametrically opposite. Like, I was in a game with Wesley and A happened, and I was in a game with Wesley and exactly never saw A at all.
That's interesting.
I feel like I can sympathize with this, particularly if you're in an early phase of gaming and you're still evolving how you handle things, is, you know, even in my games now, I change some rules every week, right?
Yeah.
And if you were in a case like Bob Meyer, like I play in one game, I don't like it, I get killed from one shot, I come back 6 months later, you know, maybe it's a totally different game at that point. And if you didn't see those sessions in between, like if somebody came in once 3 months after that, they would possibly have a completely different experience with different stats and a different way of handling hits and stuff like that. And so if people came in for one session, they might very well have be experiencing different games on a weekly basis, maybe.
That's I think that's really fair. I do think that there was a certain stability in the rules, and I think we see that through the character sheet, but those are basic
rules. That's a good
point. So there's all these more nuanced things on the fringes that I think were changing all the time. You know, through experience. It's like, okay, well, that didn't work, so maybe we better tone this down, or maybe I should have a rule that covers swimming better, or you know, because you don't want your players mad at you, so you make those adjustments.
Daniel, I think that's a really great... Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Sorry, do you have any perspective on how much the groups playing with Arneson back at that time had an expectation like we do in modern games where the players are a team who are acting cooperatively versus they were actually trying to undermine each other or work against each other?
So I think that the way to say that is yes.
So all of the above.
Some of the players, even, and this traces back to Wesley's Bronstein, right? Some of the players early on cooperated, and some of the players worked against. So, and I think to some extent that also had to do with how often they were coming to games. So you might have a character that came to a game, played a bad guy, and then so that character is now that bad guy, that wizard in the dungeon, but he's not coming to games anymore because he's, you know, got a job or a girlfriend or whatever. But you don't want to kill off his character or make it disappear because, hey, he's still part of the group. He may show up, you know, at Christmas or what have you. So those characters, when they show up, they may play a monster. They may play that bad guy. They may play a good guy if their character is dead. An example in part of this is Greg Svensson. You read one of the COTS where it talks about the Battle of Lake Gloomy, which was 1972 in summer. He was, I think, working at a summer camp. He was working that summer, had a summer job. So his character was killed off when he wasn't there. And he wasn't too happy about that, but they resurrected him. The characters had a life of their own within the world. So the amount of cooperation that happened, I think from the start, if you look at the Icelandic game, that was a cooperation game. They were all looking for Arneson, wherever he was. In later games, there was cooperation on dungeon dives, as they called them, and there was also competition where some guy like Dan Nicholson played a merchant. I don't know how active he actually was at the table, but he had a merchant character. He ran all of the – he had basically a merchant – a monopoly or a merchant mafia that ran everything. And some of the other guys didn't like that, so they set up a counter mafia, if you will, against that to try to undermine him. And that was part of what McGarry was doing. He had some of his guys digging a tunnel into the merchant's warehouse trying to steal his stuff and, you know, things like that.
I am so glad Paul asked that question because it really brings up an interesting point. We don't talk very much about these fourth wall issues. But, you know, if someone comes every week, they're interacting in a different way than someone that drops in once every 6 months or something like that. And to me, that's really relevant because I totally deal with the exact same issue. Players there every session and some that don't. And I keep those sheets and I'm like, what I'm not going to throw away these characters they made up. Right. I'm going to stick in my binder. Maybe they can be a henchman. Maybe they can be like a foe someday, or maybe the player will show up again. I totally deal with that same thing.
I also think that like players working against each other may somewhat explain the different accounts you get of even possibly the same game. I remember Wesley talking about after the game I played with him about having sessions where he ran Brownstein, and then later, like even as much as days or even a week later, heard stories coming out of things that happened at that game that he was not aware of.
Gotcha.
Right. And so like and I could totally see how that would happen in my one experience with this is that you had a lot of people in that room and people are scattering to corners. And if they have the creative leeway to be able to say, well, this happens without even consulting the DM, then, yeah, you're going to get really wildly different reports about what happened at that game.
Right.
That's right. A good point. And I can also see wanting to use players, you know, player interaction with a campaign that aren't directly in a dungeon delving session. Mm-hmm. And like me, like I've considered I haven't gotten around to it, but I considered like I have a whole lot of friends close to me and I have a bunch of friends far away. Maybe I could have like a big war game type thing whereby the players in the local session are directly interacting with something and the players at a distance are like emailing me how their dominions run or a war game type thing in the background.
Wasn't that maybe this is apocryphal, but I had heard that like some players would call Arneson up and like have him run stuff
right.
for him over
so
the phone.
One person in particular, and it may, you know, again with hyperbole, he might have been the only one.
Right.
But that would have been Fred Funk.
Hmm.
Fred Funk. He was a security guard. A lot of those guys, even Arneson, worked as a security guard for a while for some reason.
Interesting.
But Fred Funk, his main character whose claim to fame in Blackmore now is King Funk of the Orcs. So he played an orc. Mm-hmm. So he was a bad guy. But whenever he started, and I don't know exactly when that was, it was pretty early on. He just loved the game and he would pester Arneson by calling him on the phone and say, hey, can we play Blackmore? And so they would do a session over the phone.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that different, Dan, from your idea of having players email you, right? I mean,
you're right. And I mean, the other thing is you could imagine that being streamed nowadays. You could do that. You could do that live and people would watch, right?
They would. They would.
If you ever get a chance, there's a thing called Fred's World. It's hosted on the Comeback Inn, or at least the link of it is you can find the link there. That's what I mean to say.
Okay.
And Fred Funk, this was later in the late 80s. He's no longer living, but he created this mostly based on second edition. But this whole world, and it even has its own Great Svenny character in it. So it's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Was he the guy that came up with like the Orc's Way in Blackmoor, or was that different?
That's what they say, or that's what Arneson said.
Okay.
I don't know. And the reason I hesitate there is because the original maps for the dungeon were 6 levels deep, and there's the stairway that is that stairway. Goes down 6 levels, and so it looks to me like it was part of the original drawing.
Okay.
And maybe just got the label Orc's Way slapped on it, but I don't know. But yeah, he's the one that's credited for that.
Okay. And I should have given more detail. So it is this. So it's a 6 level dungeon, and there's a particular secret entrance on the first level that takes you directly to the bottommost level, and it's trapped, and you get jumped by like 1,000 orcs and 5 Balrogs or something
right.
Surprise! You should. That's
yeah. Right? And it plays when you go down the stairs. It plays Rule Britannia or something on the way down.
Yeah. It's pretty badass. Mm-hmm. All right. So I feel like we could, between the three of us, we could probably just talk about this stuff like absolutely forever. Mm. So this is a good, for anybody that is new to learning about Blackmoor, I think this is at least a good introduction.
Yeah, good.
Any final thoughts? Any final, can we wrap it up in some way? We've meandered a bit here and there.
So people should visit Daniel Boggs' blog, which always has new interesting things to look at, which I always appreciate a lot. And the address of that is what again, Daniel?
It's Hidden in Shadows at Blogger. Great. Or on Blogger. Yeah.
Great. And I hear that at some future point you're working on a new book that will be out at some point in the future, right?
Right.
I don't know how much you can talk about that.
No. Nothing secret. It was actually the first edition of it goes out as part of the rewards for the Kickstarter for the documentary Secrets of Blackmoor.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So this was, we discovered almost independently. Well, okay. So the basic story is Greg Svensson, 1973, towards the late summer, created a dungeon, which he called Tawnasport. This is probably the second, it may be the first dungeon that anyone had done other than Arneson ever. And it's very much in the same style as Blackmoor Dungeon. Not quite as complex, but, you know, it's still, it looks the same. He had that, he stocked it, it looks like twice. The second time was with the standard stuff you see in the back of the OD&D books.
Right.
Which had to have been maybe January 1974. Gave a copy of that to Dave McGarry because he went to Boston, so he'd have something he could run. Dave put it in a box, or McGarry put it in a box, forgot about it. We found those maps and then found the key of a few years ago. And so the book is that, along Great. With all sorts of old school goodness about how people used to do things back in the day.
Great. Awesome. So we will all be looking eagerly forward to that. That sounds fantastic. Thank you for sharing that, and thank you for being on the show today, Daniel.
Oh, it was great fun.
Excellent. If any other folks have thoughts on Blackmoor, experiences with Blackmoor, please post them in the comments below. We'd love to hear from you. Or any requests of other luminaries we can invite onto our show, please mention, and we'd be happy to look into it.
That's a great idea, Paul. And to all our viewers, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch, all under the handle Wandering DMs.
An audio-only version of our show is available wherever podcasts are served, as well as our own website at wanderingdms.com.
And also thanks to our patrons who support the show. And if you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
And thanks so much, Daniel, for joining us this time.
Oh, it was great. Thanks.
See ya.